Hi folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes and shapes up and down the country. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to talk to us about their lives, tell stories about what they do, and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room, and then we podcast the results. This week, we're hearing from Aoife Kelleher, the documentary maker behind the award-winning films 1 Million Dubliners, Strange Occurrences in a Small Irish Village, and Growing Up Gay. She joined us for a real fireside chat. Yes, there really was a fire behind us at Foxy John's in Dingle during our weekend Other Voices to talk to us about the art of storytelling on screen. So we've reached the final long form interview of the weekend. We've had an amazing weekend, actually. It's been great. It's been really great interviews, really lovely people. Our final interviewee is someone whose work I've admired for an awful long time. It's a documentary maker called Aoife Kelleher. Please give her a round of applause. Were documentaries part of your cultural slate when you were growing up in Swords?
Not really. So I suppose I grew up in a house that was like kind of obsessed with current affairs and news, really. And then my parents are both primary school principals, so it was just radio on all the time. It was the news, and it was kind of kind of primary school discussions as well. So it was like, you know, Gaeilge and birds and trees and all that kind of stuff. There wasn't a lot of. I don't think either of them would really be into film at all, you know. Like they like going to the cinema. My mum likes Bridget Jones, but I don't think it was part of the kind of cultural landscape, really. I was well into my teens before we got a VHS player, you know, and my parents were and are quite technophobic, so so I think it was about 16, so there wasn't a lot of that, but there was lots of discussion, you know. Yeah. And I just remember friends coming to dinner and finding my family weirdly intense around the kitchen table. You know, it's just constant debates and people being incredibly fiery. And yeah, my friends would be like, Jesus. And then, you know, it was all fine. Like, you know, and, you know, once whatever debate we were having was over, everyone was back to being completely cordial again. But yeah, so I guess it was about kind of, you know, kind of debates and issues and that kind of stuff from them, yeah. You know.
And like, can you remember like the first time a piece of film or a piece of TV captures your attention in such a way that made you think like, this is something I'd like to do when I actually escape from Swords? Everyone wants to escape.
Poor old Swords.
I know. It's a lovely place. I think I had really nice chicken wings there during the summer, so go Swords.
Yeah. That's Swords specialises in some things, including chicken wings. there's an amazing cultural output, you know, like Alt Finns are, yeah, they're from Swords, and I've loads of director friends who are from there, so I don't know, maybe it's something about kind of grim suburbia that inspires you to kind of go out and make art. I think that, what do I remember? Like, I remember, you know, Disney films and going to the cinema all the time, you know, with kind of friends' parents or with my godmother and all of that kind of stuff. And but actually, you know, my childhood was really about books, you know, and that's that, you know, if I, you know, I can go back to a period in time where I was reading, like, you know, Swallows and Amazons or, you know, Agatha Christie or, yeah, you know, anything like that. And I think, yeah, it was really about books.
The intensity of the reading experience when you're young is something incredible. Yeah. I think back to the amount of books I used to devour as a teenager, and I go, like, I mean, how was I able to read so much back then, you know?
Just having so much time. And I think that, you know, like AD and I'm a child of the 80s, and there was just a huge amount of time and an awful lot of boredom, you know, that I don't think children have nowadays. And hours that could be filled with just reading, you
right,
know.
Right.
And so, yeah.
So what was your path then after school, then, Aoife? Like, you know, was it DIT? Was it somewhere else?
No, it was DIT. So I always thought that I was going to do, you know, kind of study English and you know, or law or something like that. And then at the very last minute, just before filling in my CAO, my boyfriend's sister directs as well. And she brought me out on a set where she was shooting. I thought this was the most incredible thing. It was like, you know, it felt like just, it, first of all, it didn't feel like a job. And it just felt like running away to join the circus, you know. And I think it was a very surprising kind of last minute decision to go to DIT and study film and broadcasting. But I loved every moment of it immediately, you know. So it was quite late really that I came to film, but as soon as I did, I just adored it.
Yeah. Who were your lecturers at that stage? Who was in DIT at that stage?
So it would have been kind of Grainne Crean was, and Richard Fitzsimons, and so it was, they were fantastic. I suppose it wouldn't have been as practical a course maybe as IADT, but the incredible thing about it was our class, you know, I and lots of them are down this weekend actually, and Domenico's here.
So it's like a class reunion.
Yeah, it is like an impromptu class reunion. Yeah, but we had this incredible class, and they're still, you know, they're all still working. They're all over the place. They're, you know, RT commissioning editors and directors, and they're everywhere. And it was they were incredibly inspiring to be around, you know. And it was a brilliant environment to be in.
Okay, so like, you know, it's curious. Like, I was reading some old pieces on you, and like, we'll come to One Million Dubliners in a bit, you know. But that wasn't your first encounter with kind of like, I mean, putting debt on screen. You did a project in a funeral home, didn't you, in Angel Street?
Yeah, I was really quite. I was kind of, I don't know. I remember, I loved the Addams Family actually growing up. And because, you know, I had the Platts and the whole thing, like, people would call me Wednesday. I was absolutely delighted. And I always had, like, I loved Emily Dickinson, and I loved, you know, all that kind of, sub-gothic kind of stuff, you know. And I was really into 6 Feet Under was on when in college, and I was reading kind of Thomas Lynch, who's this Irish American.
The Undertaking.
Yeah, The Undertaking, and Bodies in Motion and at Rest. So he's this Irish American undertaker poet, and just these incredible experiences of like this idea of kind of mixing life and death, and people who are kind of at, you know, live and work on the borderline there. I thought that was a really fascinating idea, you know. And there were, as it happens on Angel Street, there were several funeral homes. It was Cargan's and Fangan's. And so for my very, very first documentary, I decided to make it on a funeral home. And it was like, you know, so the guy was talking about the process of embalming. And it was the first time I saw a dead body. It was just so, yeah. And it was kind of quirky. So it was only when I was making 1 Million Dubliners that I remembered that documentary, which was just, it was full of like, you know, star wipes and like, you know, it was appalling.
Okay, so before 1 Million Dubliners, before that, you know, there were other documentaries. But there's also like, I mean, a lot of, what I was thinking of a way to term this, gigs. There were a lot of like, I mean, like, you know, you were a jobbing director. You were like, I mean, someone for hire.
I still am a jobbing director. I mean, I was talking to like, you talk to people all the time, and there's you don't really get to earn a living just making films. I mean, certainly not at the beginning, like, you know, like Lenny Abrahamson would have made commercials, and you have to kind of mix it up a little bit, you know. So I've always worked in, you know, I've done loads of other work, like I've done Don't Tell the Bride, and I've done The Takeover, and, you know, the All-Ireland Talent Show, and as have, you know, any of the documentary directors that I know, you know, there's a huge amount of, you know, stuff that you do to pay the rent and turn a living, you know. But as soon as I graduated from college, I knew that it was, again, I hadn't thought that I would want to work in documentary, but when I graduated, there were loads of issues that I felt I wanted to kind of draw attention to, and documentary just seemed a natural way to do that. And towards the end of college, I'd seen, you know, The Thin Blue Line by Errol Morris, and Harlan County, USA, you know, about the miners' strike in Kentucky, and even the Up series by Michael Apted, you know. And just this, it struck me that documentary had this extraordinary power to, you know, tell long form stories that you just don't see in the mainstream, you know, and to give people who don't usually have that platform a platform. There's this one incredible documentary that I saw by an amazing filmmaker called Kim Long and Otto, and it was about it was about female genital mutilation, but it was all told from the point of view of this really young child who had gone through it herself and was determined to stop it from happening to her younger sister. And so she's describing, you know, her experience, and she reads a poem to her parents. And, you know, the documentary enabled her to have a voice that was equal to her parents in a way that I'm sure that she had never had before. And it was so empowering to watch that happen, you know. And so when I graduated and there were things that, you know, things about Ireland that I suppose that struck me as kind of problematic, like, you know, for example, you know, kind of gay rights and LGBT yeah. rights and those kind of things. And I thought that it would be great to be able to do something about it. So almost immediately after graduating, I started kind of shuffling around with this little camera that I'd gotten for my birthday, and, you know, kind of and doing interviews with gay and lesbian young people, and so that ended up being my first. So I started that in 2005, and in 2008 RTE agreed to commission it, and it became a series.
Growing up gay.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, so you're filming it for 3 years then, and RTE get involved. Are RTE just kind of like happy to broadcast it, or did RTE have kind of like, did they appoint a executive producer to talk you through it, or what was their involvement in the final process?
So I submitted it to RTE in 2005, just into, you know, kind of the commissioning round, and they said no, and I resubmitted it in 2006, and they went with it. So it was a full commission, so there would have been an executive producer on board, and they would have had huge oversight and everything. But
right, okay, yeah. So like let's go back then to kind of like the original film, the original people you were talking to, you know, did they all make the final cut when you started filming in 2005?
A huge amount of them did, yeah. I mean, the thing with documentaries is that, and especially with young people, you know, if you're filming them over a long period of time, their lives change, and, you know, I suppose their desire to kind of talk about what they're going through. I mean, if you know, if they're in a different place, whether, you know, if things are going better with their family or worse with their family, or if, you know, things are going better at school or worse at school, they're less likely to maybe stay on board, and that's kind of the nature of documentary, you know. Mm-hmm. you know, people. There's a kind of a rate of attrition, you know, so you have to, but most of them did, yeah. Yeah.
And do you try and persuade them then, Aoife, to kind of stay on board? Are you good at persuading people to do things they might want to do?
I don't think so, and I don't want to be good at that either. You know, I think with that documentary, because at the time, like 10 years ago, things were really different for gay and lesbian, and especially for transgender young people, and we didn't. There was no casting for that documentary series. It was anyone who said yes could be involved, and I never asked anyone directly to be involved. So we'd go to these kind of youth groups and tell them that this documentary series was happening, but we never asked anyone directly. So if they were interested, we kind of stood back and let them approach us, you know. So that was really how it worked. And we continued with them as long as they were happy to. Mm. And it was so, like, RTE were very, very anxious about it. I mean, I think that not only about discussing kind of young people and sexuality, but even discussing sex in Ireland, even still, they're, I mean, it's changing a little bit, but, you know, it can be seen as a very uncomfortable subject, and young people and sex. And so, you know, we had all these kind of procedure months and months at the start were devoted to kind of putting these procedures in place, like that the young people would talk to a counsellor at the point where they decided that they were interested in taking part, and then they'd speak to a counsellor again once they'd seen all their rushes, and then only then would they sign a release form. Mm. Which I think was, you know, it was very, you know, it was a good way to do it. It was a good way to approach it, and you knew that there would be no surprises at the end for anyone.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, and the reaction to the finished series as well was like really, really good. I remember, like, I mean, people, like, it got rave reviews, and people talked about it a lot as well.
It was really great. It was really, really positive, and it was funny. I remember we wanted to do follow-ups on it, and because it felt like, you know, we'd barely scratch the surface of what was going on in that community in Ireland. And I remember, so we came back and we were saying, we'd love to do a follow-up, or we'd love to do something about kind of transgender young people. And Orty said, we've ticked that box now. So, which turned out to be not the case at all, you know. Yeah. And actually, what happened over the following few years, right up until last year, you know, it was in an extraordinary time of change, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting, like, if someone does a similar film 10 years on after your one, you know, the whole landscape has changed completely. All the issues that, like, I mean, were around those kids telling their stories on screen they're still there to some extent, but, like, they've diminished a little bit.
It's like you can see the difference in, it was the organisation that I worked with, and you can see the difference in those youth groups, in that it used to be, there used to be a real sense of kind of refuge there, you know, and that this was where those young people could go to be themselves in a way that they couldn't in the outside world, you know, and it was, there was this lovely kind of feeling of solidarity and togetherness and love and all that kind of stuff. And now you go there and it's a youth group like any other, and there'd be kind of cliques and, you know, and all that kind of thing. And it's because they, you know, for a lot of people, or a lot of young people, especially in, you know, in Dublin, and, you know, maybe don't need that refuge to the same extent that they did then, you know.
Okay, so after Growing Up Gay then, I mean, the next one on your slate was The Symmetries.
Yeah.
The Last Night in the Symmetry, yeah. 1 Million Dubliners. Like, it's a powerful piece of film for many, many reasons, you know. I mean, the subject matter, you know, the people you talk to, the story. Obviously, when you start, like, we'll talk about it now, but, like, obviously when you started, you had something else in mind completely. You had to have.
I suppose, like, we knew that, you know, I knew, like, I'd grown up in the north side of Dublin, like, you know, Glasnevin was kind of always part of the landscape, you know, the O'Connell's Tower was part of the skyline, you know, and there were loads of, you know, I felt that it was a place that I knew very, very well. And, you know, I knew that we wanted to do, like, kind of a contemporary piece, so that it wouldn't necessarily, you know, wasn't really about, the history would encompass some of the history, but really it was about that borderline that I spoke of, people working on the kind of the borderline, yeah, between life and death, and people for whom, like, kind of death is part of their everyday lives and that kind of thing. And you know, you almost as soon as I went there, the first thing I did was take this tour, and I met Shane McComish, and, you, yeah, know, so he was, you know, he's this extraordinary person, and was this extraordinary person, and as soon as you met him, you'd know that, like, you'd follow him anywhere, like around the cemetery for starters, but he just had, he was just this,
he exuded charisma.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and he had this old Dublin kind of quality that felt really, you know, right for the film as well. Like, I remember I had this kind of, you know, idea of how I wanted the film to feel, and it was about things like, you know, the Merino waltz, and, you know, just kind of like little kind of elements and moods. And he just embodied all of that with his, like, you know, his accent and his tweed and his, you know, his kind of republicanism, and yet his kind of, you know, egalitarianism as well. And he was just, yeah, he was just very fun and, right, very funny.
So you didn't know him before you did that tour?
No.
Okay, so then over the course of the film, I mean, you got to know him, you got to know him obviously pretty well, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, he would send really funny texts all the time, like, there's a dog funeral in the cemetery next week, would you like to film it? I was like, oh my God, amazing, really? He's like, don't be ridiculous. And he would just, like, he would slag me off all of the time. And, you know, I kept buying and then losing his book, Dead Interesting. And I think it was like the day before he died, I texted him to say, you know, I've just bought my fifth copy of your book, McComish, you're going to bankrupt me. And it just had that tick that said read, and then there was, you know, no reply.
Right.
And that was, so that was the last time I ever spoke to him,
right,
or communicated with him at all. So that, I mean, you know, we were editing that film, you know, that we were already in the edit, I was already kind of, you know, we were already shaping it and everything. When I, you know, I got a call from my friend to say, Shane McComish dead.
Yeah.
And I said, like, don't be ridiculous. But as far as I was concerned, there was going to be one more day of filming, and he was going to bring us around at Easter to kind of show all the different kind of, you know, Republican and Nationalist factions, and as well, you know, as well as the kind of state, and, you know, to just talk about Easter in the cemetery. But instead, our last day of filming was his funeral.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, you know, I suppose it's part of documentary that, you know, you can never really predict what's going to happen, but
yeah,
that was that was tough, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, after that then, I mean, like, the this year's film, I mean, Strange Occurrences, the Knock film, it's really curious. I mean, I used to, like, every summer I drive from Galway up to Donegal, you know, and I passed the sign for Knock, and I always kind of go, like, someday I'm going to take that road and see what it looks like. I remember going there years ago on pilgrimages as a kid, and I finally bit the bullet about two summers ago and said, okay, I'm going to Knock, and I just couldn't get over what it's become, you know, what it's like now, right now. And watching Strange Occurrences brought me back there, and it reminded me of certain things. The place of Knock in Irish culture, there's a few songs, Chrissy Moore has a song about it, Bellex One references in a song as well. It just seems that it's one of these places, it's another. Popular culture doesn't go anywhere near it.
That's actually, and the public culture doesn't go anywhere near it. That's a really huge part of why I wanted to make it, you know, because I'd never been to Knock before deciding to make the documentary, and it wasn't a place that I knew, and even being there, it felt quite alien to me, like kind of so different to Glasnevin, which, you know, I felt was kind of in my DNA, you know, whereas Knock, it's very stark looking. The architecture is unlike anything I've ever seen. Yeah. Some of the architecture looks like something from the house in Beetlejuice or something. It's extraordinary. So
it's an extraordinary town. I mean, like, this is a small County Mayo town that, yeah, like, you know, it's a Marian pilgrimage town, and it attracts pilgrims from all over Ireland and all over the world. It's the place that's produced Knock Airport as well.
Yeah, but the fact that it was what convinced me that it should be made was the fact that 1.5 million people go there every year, and as you're saying, like, media and culture don't touch on it, you know. And so even though in 2014 that, you know, this would have been kind of pre-Brexit, pre-Trump, pre, you know, the Italian referendum and the Austrian election this weekend, there was a sense that, you know, there's a huge, I mean, 1.5 million in a country the size of Ireland, like, that's a huge phenomenon, and there's a huge sense that a large part of Ireland doesn't know what the other part is doing, and you know that these people would be so completely ignored, and you know, it's funny
you mentioned Brexit and Trump there in reference to Knock, because you're right. I mean, it is a part of the country, it's still a part of an Ireland, but yet there is a kind of we exist in these bubbles. That's a bubble. But we've also living in a bubble, kind of like on the liberal kind of East Coast as well, that we don't kind of realise what's going on. And 1.5 million people is huge. But, like, did you kind of find, as you were filming it, was there any kind of trust issues? Did they know where you're coming from? Were they kind of going like, oh, is she going to do a piss take here?
Absolutely not. And actually, I would have, in a way, that was what I was expecting. But, you know, The media may not be aware of them, but they're very much aware of the media, and they're very, very savvy, and they're very aware of, you know, the power of it. And they're all going in the Late Late Show on Friday, and they're very excited about that.
Just come Friday.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, they want to bring people in. They have a huge marketing department. They, you know, they want to get bodies into Knock, you know, and so any means that they can get to publicise it, they're delighted, you know. Right. So they're very keen to take part. Right. Yeah.
Aside from the houses that look like Beetlejuice, I mean, what other aspects of kind of the Knock culture stuck with you? I mean, did the traveller culture, like, did that make any big impact on you?
Yeah, I suppose
that... for this time, when I visited last time, that was something I was kind of going, I'd heard from my parents were kind of saying it's a big part of it now, and I was just struck that, like, it's huge.
Yeah. I mean, I think that... you know, Knock is incredibly significant to the traveller population, to the travelling community, and they're a very visible part of all of the big kind of occasions there, and then also, you know, kind of traveller families who would be living in the UK now come back all the time, and it's. They're a really big part of the community there, you know, and yet there isn't necessarily a huge amount of mixing either. There's a kind of a sense that they, you know, keep to themselves, and then kind of the people of Mayo keep to themselves. It's interesting, you know, but right. Everything about Knock strikes you immediately. I mean, the fact that, you know, you've got eight shops run by eight siblings selling identical religious goods and all making a living beside each other on the main street, that's absolutely extraordinary, you know, and you know, and the things that they're selling.
Yeah. Yeah,
like
yeah.
the happy death cross, which you keep for, you know, to you know, in the hopes of having a happy death. And
did that appeal to your did that appeal to your internal Adams family?
Yeah, I liked the happy. I kind of made a point of shooting the happy death cross because I loved that. Like, I think it's a great idea, you know. And if you could get a talisman for that, I think, you know, we'd all be into it. But and even, you know, watching how the fact that, like, you know, the Pope Benedict pictures and, you know, they're all on sale now and it's like kind of bargain basement and Francis is the new guy in town and he's really popular and. It's fascinating. It's very, very funny. And like, you know, Bernie was one of the shopkeepers and he's one of eight siblings, all of whom was gifted a shop by their father. And he's like they're really into kind of the commerce of the whole thing and like, you know, getting one over on the siblings, even though like they'd be always very polite about it. But you can tell that each of them wants kind of the big new statue and the big new saint and. The big one this year is Our Lady of Knots.
Our Lady of Knots.
Our Lady of Knots. So this is apparently a very this is Pope Francis' big thing into Our Lady of Knots and Bernie got it first. So
go Bernie.
Okay. Yeah.
So aside from kind of like the business of selling religious kind of souvenirs, did you get a sense up there of kind of a political changes, political ideas, like in terms of like people who go there, the feeling you talked there about like the fact that they half the country doesn't realize they exist, that they're very much aware that like the other half exists. Did you get a kind of feeling that there was any political undercurrents that could be tapped into?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, on the one hand, like, for example, like Knox in Enda Kenny's constituency. So, and I mean, and you know, he would have given those, like, he gave an extraordinary speech about, you know, kind of the Cloyne report. And, you know, so he's been kind of quite vocal and critical of the church. And yet he's always there at the big events in Knock and, when Archbishop Dolan arrived, he, you know, Enda Kenny was front and centre on the runway in the high-vis jacket and he gave this kind of speech that was kind of gently kind of condemning of the church, but, you know, very much keen to kind of stay in with the faithful as well. And at one point in the speech where he said that, you know, as he looked out on the glorious day and the plane coming in, he almost kind of said a prayer, sort of. And so it's just kind of like walking that fine line. But, you know, the kind of, there is a sense, I know what you mean, there isn't...
Just in this post-Trump, post-Brexit world, that, like, I mean, something like that, that constituency like that could be tapped into.
I don't know, because obviously there are other elements in, you know, kind of like obviously the immigration thing is not an issue in Knock. I mean, you know, more people leave Knock than come to live there, you know, so there isn't that kind of, I mean, there is definitely a sense that they're being ignored and kind of rejected, you know. I mean, I think that the Irishness depicted in 1 Million Dubliners is a kind of an Irishness that we're all very, very comfortable with. You know, the kind of the artists and the rebels and, you know, the poets and these extraordinary, you know, these extraordinary women. You know, the Irishness in Knock, it's something that's a bit more polarizing, you know, and I think there is a sense that they are, you know, at a pole.
Right. What are you working on at the moment?
So I'm working a few bits and pieces for RTÉ at the moment and developing, so kind of working on the next kind of film project. So
is this about elder care, is it?
Yeah. So I'm doing a documentary for RTÉ1 about care for older people and a documentary for RTÉ2 that's about this pan-European survey of millennials. And in the 18 to 34 bracket, the Irish are the most liberal country in Europe and it's really very interesting and very liberal about sex. So the majority of people have had sex with more than one partner or would like to. So so there's lots of interesting things in there. And I love it. It's been really interesting. I mean, in some ways, the two films are kind of companion pieces, you know, in that they're quite ethnographic. And it's about, like, they were made for an Irish audience, really, you know, and it's about... it's about Irishness. The both of them are about Irishness, and you know, and what it is to live and die, and you know, and our kind of attitudes to faith and religion, and how they've been shaped, you know. So yeah. I don't know, the next one might be different.
Okay, so what's on your kind of like, I mean, to like long-term list? I mean, like you talked earlier about Tim Blue Line, like, I mean, you know, you've covered death in quite a bit. Like you say, you've covered Ireland. If you had the option to do anything, if you like the big passion project, what would it be?
Well, I'm hoping to do more drama. So I'm writing with two friends of mine at the moment, and so I'm hoping to do a little bit more drama. Yeah, that'd be really, really interesting. And comedy, which is terrifying. But so there are things that I kind of have on the back burner, but I think I'll always work in documentary, I think. And okay. You know, that's, yeah.
Cool. Last question for me then. Really appreciate you taking time to come down to us here in Dingle as well. Last question. What documentary have you seen in the last couple of years that has just really stuck with you?
The one that I thought was absolutely fascinating and completely baffling was, I saw Wiener this year, and it's just really stuck with me.
I wish we mentioned it earlier on with kind of Ethna, when she was here about the view of the year. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible. And it's, you know, from the very beginning, you're wondering, why did he do it? You know, like, I mean, it's the access and the fact that they're so close to him in particular, you know, and it's just, why would he give so much access when he knew, you know, what was going on and how much was at stake? And it's an extraordinary, like, you know, to be that close to a scandal, and to have so much access to the person at the center of it, who seems to be just this incredibly compulsive person, you know, but who wants to document it all at the same time, yeah. You know, even though he is clearly completely unpredictable, even to himself.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible. I mean, it's very rare that you get that kind of access to that kind of personality in that kind of high stakes scenario, and
BBC 4 like screened recently, so I saw it for a second time, and what struck me was her humans, like her reaction all the way through, and she was not happy with the documenting at all.
No not at all. And she's clearly a very, very private person who was being kind of dragged along by the force of his personality, you know, and yet at the same time, I mean, there's a moment where, you know, the latest scandal has just come out about him, and she reminds everyone that as they're leaving the building, like, that they have to, you know, to smile and to perform for the cameras. So she's, you know, she's aware of what it is to be a public personality, and yet clearly loathes it. Yeah, I thought it was amazing. It was really well done. It was pacey and funny and just jaw-droppingly horrifying.
Brilliant. Eva Keller, thank you very much. Eva Keller.
Thanks to Eva for coming along to Dingle, and thanks to Banter and Other Voices producer Molly King, and Salman, Stephen, Andrew Cotty, and all the Foxy Johns and Other Voices for their hospitality and help. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news or up to Banter. Plus, you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.